So the title of this workshop is Biological Switches and Clocks. So I thought it might be a good idea to start off with two introductory lectures, one on switches and one on clocks. So I was elected to do the switches talk, and Albert will talk about biological clocks first thing Thursday morning. And it's almost impossible to talk about switches without talking about clocks and vice versa. So there'll be a little bit of crossover, but I'll try to concentrate on biological switches, on chemical bistability. And I want to first, the first half of my talk will be mostly about chemistry, just a little bit of biology. So chemical switches and decision making in chemistry, if you can call it that. And then we'll try to we'll switch gears and talk more about what the cells are doing and the machinery that cells are using to make decisions. And the first half of this talk I put together last night, so it's not guaranteed. And I put it together basically from the top of my head because I didn't have access to any of my old publications and things like that, which are all back in Blacksburg. So I may have a few of the details wrong here and there. This is not guaranteed. But the basic story is correct. I'm pretty confident of that. Okay? I want to start with this paper that was published by Otto Roessler in 1972. Some of you know Roessler's name from Chemical Chaos. But this is one of his earlier papers. This is the English translation of the title, Basic Circuits of Fluid Automata and Relaxation Systems. And he was asking a question. He was kind of cataloging early work done on chemical reaction network theory and what it takes in a chemical system to create a switch. And this is just one of many tables in that paper. This is called a Nicht-Rücksetzbare Schalter. A Schalter is a switch, and a Rücksetzbare Schalter is a resettable switch, and this is a non-resettable switch. So these are little chemical reaction mechanisms, purely theoretical, that create switches that can be in two states, on and off, and you can switch it, but then you can't switch it back. And then there's another table of resettable switches and things he called flip-flops and things like that. So he kind of cataloged these ideas that were floating around in the literature in various places. And it's a very literal translation of the German. The German is pretty difficult, and the translation doesn't help a whole lot, actually. But I'm going to come back to this paper and kind of tell you what the conclusion was. But I want to back up a little bit from Roessler's paper about the theory of chemical switches and where some of these ideas were floating around in the literature in the 50s and 60s. So actually, probably the earliest discussion of switches in a biological context, and in a paper by Novick and Wiener in 1957 called Enzyme Induction as an All or None Phenomenon. And what they showed, what they were studying was the utilization of glucose and lactose by E. coli, and the cell has to make a decision about which one of those sugars it's going to use, and it always decides to use the glucose first, and when it uses up the glucose, then it decides it'll use the lactose, a secondary sugar. And the explanation, and they showed that was an all or none decision. They don't kind of make a half of a decision. They use them both at the same time. They either use the one sugar or they use the other sugar. And the basis of that all or none phenomenon is explained in terms of the Jacob and Monod theory of the lac operon. So the sugar, the alternative sugar is lactose, which may be supplied in the environment. In order for the cell to metabolize lactose, it has to bring it in and then break it down into six carbon sugars and metabolize them to gain energy. But normally, the cell doesn't use lactose because it doesn't have the permease that brings lactose into the cell, and it doesn't have the galactosidase enzyme that breaks the lactose sugar down. Those two enzymes are encoded in the DNA in the lac operon. There's a third gene as well here. And normally, the expression of these genes is under repression in the system. So there's a repressor that keeps those genes off. And so the cell can't use lactose, it uses glucose instead. When the glucose runs out, That repressor has to be removed so that proteins P and G can be expressed. And the repressor is removed by a form of lactose called allolactose, which is created by the galactosidase. So the way the system works is, well, there's positive feedback in the system because normally the repressor is keeping the permease down, and when you don't have the permease, you can't get lactose into the system. But if there's a little bit of permease and a little lactose gets in, gets converted into allolactose, it can start to turn down the repressor, and that turns up the expression of this gene. So there's a positive feedback loop here that can engage, and the system can switch over to the on state where these genes are being expressed and lactose is being metabolized. So essentially this little system, because of the positive feedback that's built into it, has these two different states. The lactose off state where it's not utilizing lactose, and the on state where it is utilizing lactose.
John?
Yes?
Didn't Max Delbrück have an earlier switch?
Did he?
Yeah, it was a metabolic switch. And it was in the context of discussions about the possibility that there was actually sort of genetic information in the cytoplasm, some plasmid genes.
I think that was earlier. Likes to cite the first reference to multiple cell states as one of the remark by Delbrück in 1949 in a meeting at the CNRS, okay, in Marseille. And there is a one or two page remark.
It's very short.
So there is no model there whatsoever.
Okay.
He discusses
the possibility. Okay.
But,
give me a PowerPoint slide with that on it, and I'll stick it in. Okay, so the next part of my story, I would refer to the paper by Prigogine and Lefevre in 1968, where they introduced the brucellator, and they were primarily interested in oscillations. But actually, the brucellator is built around this chemical reaction where A plus 2X goes to 3X. It's an autocatalytic production of X from some molecule A. And that's kind of the heart of the brucellator. It makes the brucellator essentially do all of its interesting things. And Schlegel kind of simplified, from my point of view, Schlegel kind of simplified the brucellator to create a very simple model of a theoretical model of a chemical switch. And all he does is have this reversible reaction occurring in a flow reactor, and you input A and X into the flow reactor, and then you let them flow out of the reactor. And the condition is going to be that the concentration of A in the input stream is very much larger than X, so we can consider A to be at a constant concentration in the reactor. And we only need to write a differential equation for the time rate of change of the concentration of X. And there are two chemical reactions, the forward reaction and the reverse reaction, and then there's the flow of X into the reactor and the washout of X out of the reactor. And if you solve, if you want to look for steady state concentrations of X in the reactor, you set the X dt equal to zero, and you have to solve a cubic algebraic equation. And we know that if the parameters A and F and X zero in this cubic equation are chosen correctly, we can get three positive steady states. And it's often illustrated in this fashion, where I plot the steady state concentration of X on this axis and the two kinetic parameters in the system, A and F, on the other two axes. And what you get when the system shows bistability is this folded surface. It looks like the pleat in a piece of fabric when you plot X against those two control parameters. And there's a region, the pleated region, where you have three steady states, an on state and an off state and an unstable state in between. But then in other regions of the control space, the control parameters, the system shows only one steady state solution. Okay, so it's possible to get bistability of this sort in a very simple chemical reaction system in a flow reactor, theoretically. There's a rather elaborate theory behind this fold that's due to René Thom and his disciple Christopher Zeeman. and they called it a cusp catastrophe. And they were mathematicians, so they weren't particularly thinking about the chemical reaction systems, but just what's the generic properties of these kinds of differential equations. And they showed, essentially, René Thom showed that there's this very elegant generic theory of the singularities of these sorts of fields, and this is one of the simplest kind of a singularity. He calls it the cusp catastrophe. It's just this folded surface, and if you project the fold down onto the control plane A and B, you get this very characteristic cusp-shaped region, and inside the cusp the system is bistable, and outside the cusp the system is monostable. And what they argued was, this is a generic phenomena, this is what you can expect to see in differential equations of the appropriate kind of complexity, and essentially all bistable systems look the same from this point of view. Yes?
I know you mentioned that there wasn't a sort of chemical motivation behind this, but in fact, it's greatly motivated by these conversations with Cornell.
Yes, it was. And that's a topic for another discussion that Albert will lead sometime if we ask him to. And I don't want to go into those details here. Yes.
Yes, if you have bistability, like in the case you don't have this cusp situation, you can always. If you have a switch, let's say, you can always find this bistability in some range of parameters.
No, not that you can always find bistability, but in a reaction system that shows bistability, you can expect it, when looked at from the right point of view, to look like this, to look like this folded surface. There will be a region. So we talk about the control plane or the parameter plane, A and B. Those would be the kinetic rate constants in the system. And if you can control those experimentally, and I'll show how you can do it in just a second, then you ought to be able to adjust your control parameters to get into the region where the system is bistable. But if you twiddle those control parameters, you might pop out of the region that's bistable and go into the region that's monostable. But in general, you can expect the system to look like this. And if you have two parameters that you can control, you can expect to see these cusp-shaped regions where the system is bistable. Okay? But the nice thing about this is that it's a very general theory. It's not specific to a particular kind of chemical reaction with particular chemicals and particular rate constants. It's kind of a generic property of nonlinear differential equations. Okay? Another way to view this this surface is to make like what's called a one parameter cut through the surface. So we fix the value of A and just change the value of B and plot X as a function of B. That's called a one parameter bifurcation diagram, and you typically get, for a bistable system, an S-shaped curve like this. The upper state's the on state, the lower state's the off state, and the intermediate state is the unstable state. And then when you project the cusp down onto the AB plane to get the cusp region, that's called a two-parameter bifurcation diagram. Okay, next part of the story, I want to talk a little bit about the Belozov-Jabotinsky reaction, which has been mentioned a couple of times. So this is a chemical reaction involving bromate ions and bromide ions in acidic solution. And sometimes you add malonic acid, but you don't have to add malonic acid. The curious properties of this reaction were just first discovered by Belouzov in the 1950s. Many of you know the story. He tried to get it published, but the referees always rejected it. They said it's impossible for these things to happen in chemical systems. All you had to do was mix the chemicals together, and you could see it quite easily. Even I could do it as a graduate student. The referees never bothered to check, I guess. And in 1972, there's a classic paper by Field, Korosh, and Noyes, published in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, that kind of laid out the mechanism underlying all the curious behavior in the Belouzov-Jabotinsky reaction.
And containment himself with purity or
anything? No. Belousov was mixing. He was studying these reactions for completely other purposes, and saw that it started oscillating in his test tube. And they never bothered to do the experiment. They just said it was impossible. And And Jabotinsky was a graduate student in the 60s, and his professor, what was his professor's name? Schnorr, suggested that he pursue that reaction, and he made more studies, and times had changed, and finally was able to publish it in the 60s.
Schnorr's paper eventually appeared in the Proceedings of a Conference in Siberia.
Yeah, it appeared in a very obscure place, but you can still get a copy of it. If you can read Russian, it's... worth looking at. Okay, the Field-Karl-Schnoy's paper in the Journal of American Chemical Society, it's been cited thousands or tens of thousands of times. It's one of those citation classics now. They kind of laid out what the underlying mechanism has to be. And it's all bromine chemistry, and it's pretty nasty. I mean, only an inorganic chemist can like this kind of stuff. But the basic idea is that your basic reactants are bromate and bromide, and the bromine is in different oxidation states, and then the bromine atoms start exchanging oxygen atoms and electrons. So these are oxidation reduction reactions, and this is a sequence of two electron oxidation reduction reactions where these bromine molecules are passing the electrons around, and they're going from, this is a positive oxidation state and a negative oxidation state, they go to molecular bromine at zero oxidation state by a two electron process. That's process A. And then there's process B, in which they do one electron. There's a one electron pathway here, and the electron is supplied by iron ion. So the iron ion goes from plus 2 to plus 3, supplies an extra electron, makes free radicals, and it's a different pathway which produces HBrO2 in an autocatalytic reaction. Bromate plus HBrO2 goes to 2HBrO2. So there's an autocatalytic reaction here that involves the transition metal ion that supplies the electron, the extra electron that's needed. Okay? But then it basically accomplishes the same thing. It converts bromate and bromide into molecular bromine. And when this is run as a switch, the system switches back and forth between these two processes, where process A is the dominant process, or process B is the dominant process. And you can study this reaction in a flow reactor. And these experiments were done at the Paul Pascal Institute in Bordeaux, at Paco, Vidal, de Kepper, Bottenard. The names associated with these beautiful experiments. If you're doing the BZ reaction, the inflow contains bromate ions and bromide ions and iron ions. Flow it into the reactor, stir it up, and see what it does. And you can draw what are bifurcation diagrams, although that's not what they called them at first. The two parameters that you control in this case are the flow rate through the reactor and, say, the bromate ion concentration in the input stream. So you have two parameters that are easily controlled experimentally, and they just sampled the reactor. They laid down a grid of parameter values with maybe 50 or 100 points and sampled what the reactor was doing, and sketched out this diagram, which they initially called a phase diagram, a cross-shaped phase diagram, because it basically had this cross shape. And inside the lower part of the cross is where the system showed bistability. It could be in either a bromide high state or a bromide low state. And outside of that cross, it was either monostable with A process dominating or monostable with the B process dominating. But above the point of the cross, there was usually a little region where the system showed oscillations, and then it would be monostable outside there. So actually, they used this as a recipe for finding new chemical oscillators. And now they just started going through their inorganic chemistry book to find reactions that had the possibility of showing autocatalysis through a free radical mechanism, and they put it into their flow reactor, and they twiddled their parameters until they could find a region of bistability, and then they just followed up to the tip of the bistable region and looked out there, and they almost always found oscillations, and then they discovered a whole a dozen or so other oscillating chemical reactions by this technique. Of course, it became clear later what they were seeing was the cusp. Okay, but because of the, you know, the crudeness of the sampling of the space, it looked like an X, but it was really a cusp. And I hope I'll be able to talk about later, if I have time, why the little oscillatory region appears at the top of the cusp. Okay, you with me? This is all chemistry so far. Yes, Boris.
What flows out? So molecular bromide. So
everything flows out. Whatever's in the reactor.
Right, and it oscillates. But the fundamental change is that I'm looking for some clear flux. So clear, right? We have to beat that referee's thermodynamics argument. So ultimately, reduction of R.
Yeah, incoming bromate, I forgot the minus sign, right? Incoming bromate and bromide, they're carrying free energy into the reactor. They react and form bromine, which flows out of the reactor. And there's always a loss of free energy here. So this is an open chemical reaction system. It's not at thermodynamic equilibrium, it's at a kinetic steady state. Mm-hmm. Right? All this was worked out by Prigogine's school in Brussels. I'm not going to go into all the theory, I'm just trying to give an overview here. Okay? But any of these issues we can tackle in more detail if you'd like to, with Albert's help.
But just for clarity, sure. What's actually oscillating?
Well, the nicest thing to monitor here would be the bromide ion concentration in the reactor with a bromide ion selective electrode. And then you'll see the bromide ion. It's either very high or very low when it's bistable, or the bromide ion concentration will oscillate in time. Mm-hmm. Okay, all this works very nicely in a flow reactor, and you need the flow because you have to all the time be putting in the iron in the plus 2 state, because it's only converted into the plus 3 state and flows out. What Belousov did by accident was to have some organic molecules in the mixture, and they got, those organic molecules got brominated by the molecular bromine, and then the iron plus 3 oxidized the brominated organic molecules and regenerated the molecular, the bromide, and turned iron 3 back to iron 2. And that's why the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction can oscillate for a while in a test tube in a closed system, because there was negative feedback into the system. I don't want to get into all the chemistry, but this is just the basic idea of the connection between switches and oscillators. The switch gives you the two states, and if you can control your parameters, you can get it to switch on, and then you move your parameter, you can get it to switch off, and you can go around the loop. Right? But it's a little hard to do in chemistry unless you can put some negative feedback into the system. So when you jump to one state, it causes you to move in your control space to force the jump back to the other state. That would be the negative feedback. Then you can get an oscillator out of that. So these are the basic ideas that were floating around in the 70s and 80s due to these experiments that the physical chemists were doing and the theoretical analysis that was coming out of Prigogine's group and other groups. Okay, the origonator is a simplification of the complicated bromine chemistry in the Fieldkraus-Noise mechanism. And we just keep track of two chemicals. Here, Q is bromate, and X is HBrO2, and Y is bromide ions. So here's bromate plus HBrO2 goes to 2HBrO2. That's the autocatalytic process, and this is the one electron pathway. And then this is bromate plus bromide goes to HBrO2. HBrO2 plus bromide eventually makes molecular bromine. That's the two electron pathway. So this is a simplification. And you can write a, you assume that bromate ions are in excess, and you write two differential equations for HBr2 and bromide ions, and analyze these by the classical methods of nonlinear differential equations. You draw a phase plane where you plot X concentration and Y concentration, and look at the Nolk lines, which are where the right-hand sides are equal to zero. So you set the right-hand side equal to zero for the X equation, and you get this line. Only Y is changing, so the vector field is vertical. The X dt is equal to zero, but the Y dt is not equal to zero. Then you set the Y dt equal to zero and plot that. It's just a hyperbola here. That's where only X is changing, so the vector field is horizontal. So you can sketch out the vector field for these differential equations in the phase plane very quickly by these techniques. And if you choose the parameters correctly, if you're in the cusp region, then these two Nolk lines intersect in three places. Those are the three steady states of the system. That's clearly a stable steady state and a stable steady state. And the one in the middle is an unstable steady state. Okay, so these are the kinds of mathematical techniques that are very useful to understand how to connect the bistability, the observed bistability, to the underlying chemistry. Okay, and this is all chemistry, not biochemistry, right? These are just bromine molecules.
What's the origin of the name?
The origonator comes from the Brusselator. And the Brusselator actually comes from me. I'm responsible. So Prigogine and Lefebvre published their paper in 1968. And I started working on it as a graduate student. And it was always referred to as the Prigogine-Lefebvre model of an oscillating reaction. And I got tired of saying Prigogine-Lefebvre over and over again. I just started calling it the Brusselator, just in the lab. And when I published my first paper on this, I introduced the terminology, and I think Prigogine was offended at first, wasn't he? He thought I was making fun of him or something. I was just a little graduate student. But it caught on, and actually came to regret introducing the terminology. The origonator was okay. The Brusselator is cute, right? Origonator is already stretching it, and now there's a whole bunch of other aters which are really sound pretty bad. Okay, so let's come back to Rössler's paper. So it was in this kind of milieu. This is what people were thinking about at this time when Rössler published this paper and made this catalog of the kinds of, we could call these motifs now. These are little chemical reaction motifs that can create resettable and non-resettable switches in chemistry. And there's a very interesting sentence at the end of Rössler's paper, which when translated into English says something like this. In this manner, the class of chemical switching networks will be promising candidates for a possible new technology of chemical reaction systems. Now, what did he mean by that? Well, at the time, not only Rössler, he was maybe the first person to say this, I'm not sure, but other people soon thereafter were saying, hey, look, in a chemical flow reactor, we can create switches and oscillators, so we ought to be able to make a chemical computer, right? Because that's all you need, are switches and oscillators. And so we should be able to make a chemical computer out of these things. And everybody got all excited about it. All the physical chemists, I think, got excited about this idea of making a chemical computer. And, you know, I was just a graduate student at the time, scratching my head and saying, why would anybody want to do that? Right? That is the dumbest idea I have ever heard. Do you think you're going to compete with electronic computers, with a chemical computer? Do you want to carry around a flow reactor to add 1 + 1? You know, it doesn't make any sense, you know, to try to build a chemical computer. But then, you know, I was in that mode for about a year until it finally dawned on me that we already had a chemical computer, that the living cell is the chemical computer. It's a little bag, it's open, energy coming in and going out. It's full of these biochemical reactions and these genetic regulatory networks, which obey all the same laws of those chemical reaction systems that the physical chemists had been working out in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it's actually carrying out computations. This is a famous diagram from a Hanahan and Weinberg paper in Cell in 2000, just a cartoon of the cell. This is the cell membrane with receptors embedded in the membrane. These receptors pick up signals from external factors, growth factors, anti-growth factors, death factors, that pick up signals from outside the cell. They pick up signals from inside the cell. This is called a DNA damage sensor, and here's a good one, the abnormality sensor. I need one of those, I suppose. And those signals are then processed by this control system to generate outputs, changes in gene expression, which you can call growth and development, changes in cell proliferation, so the reproduction and division of a cell, or an output which is programmed cell death or apoptosis. And there are other outputs of these control systems. So we have an input-output system, and in between the input and the output is some sort of an information processing system that works on those signals and figure out what's the appropriate response of the cell and then gives the command to do those responses. And that's the real ultimate chemical computer. That's the one that's really important. That's the one that's really interesting, and the one that we still know very little about, how this information processing is being done. Okay, you with me? So when this finally dawned on me, that's when I left physical chemistry and I bought a copy of Leninger and read it from cover to cover and did a postdoc in biochemistry and cell biology because, you know, physical chemistry was left behind. This was the really important problem to try to deal with. Okay. Now, how do we begin to break down or to understand this information processing system? It's way too complicated to try to understand in all of its complexity, right? And you wouldn't try to understand a computer by looking at the wiring diagram of a Pentium chip and try and figure out how it works. You know, if you're going to study electrical engineering, you've got to take EE101 and start looking at little circuits and understand what those little circuits do and how you hook together little circuits to make bigger and more complicated circuits. And we have to take the same approach here. We have to look at the little motifs that are operating, the little circuits that are operating, see what their characteristics are and how you hook them together and what happens when you hook these circuits together. Now, we can't expect this to work like an electrical engineering system. We can only adopt the mentality. We can't adopt, I don't think, very many of the methods. But we have to adopt the mentality, but we have to be open to the fact that this is a chemical computer, not an electrical computer, and it's going to be governed by fundamental principles that are much different. Okay?
Can you say, how is the frequency of the oscillations related to the fundamental parameters?
Well, it is. It's a function of the parameters.
The question is, how time scales of the chemical reactions and time scales of oscillations?
That's a difficult question, and I'm going to dodge it by saying I'm talking about switches, not oscillators, and maybe Albert will say something about it. But, you know, I would like to discuss it with you at length offline, okay? So, here are some of the motifs that appear over and over again. The receptors bind to a ligand and activate transcription factors, in this case SMADs. It's a class of transcription factors, and those transcription factors then go into the nucleus and turn up the production of a certain protein. In this case, it's a protein called P21, And P21 binds to this protein complex here and inhibits it, and that blocks cell proliferation. Okay, so there's a direct signal from an anti-growth or anti-proliferation factor through a transcription factor through an inhibitory protein which blocks progression through the cell cycle. Okay, so transcription factor upregulates synthesis of an unstable protein. That's a little motif. And the other motif that appears over and over again are these protein phosphorylation pathways. In this case, a protein called MAP kinase is getting phosphorylated. There's an enzyme, a MAP kinase kinase, that puts the phosphate group on, and there's a phosphatase that takes the phosphate group off. Okay, that's a very common motif. And actually, Albert, I am going to talk about zero order ultra sensitivity. I forgot. Okay, so this basic motif, upregulating the expression of a protein, is absolutely trivial. We could, for this little motif, we write a differential equation that says the concentration of the protein is rate of synthesis minus rate of degradation. And we look for the steady state solution where the rate of synthesis equals the rate of degradation, and clearly the concentration of the output, the response protein, just increases linearly with the strength of the signal. As you increase the activity of the transcription factor, the readout is the amount of the response protein in the cell. Okay, so this is just a simple linear signal response curve. I plot in the signal response curve, I always plot the output of the system, the concentration of some chemical, as a function of the input that I call the signal. Okay, more interesting case is the one that Goldbitter and Koshin considered back in the early 80s, where you have this response protein that gets phosphorylated by a kinase and dephosphorylated by a phosphatase. And you want to know what's the steady state phosphorylation level of this protein as a function of the activity of the kinase and the activity of the phosphatase. So what Albert and Dan did was to write down this differential equation using Michaelis-Menten kinetics for these two enzyme-catalyzed reactions, and look for the steady state where the rate of the forward reaction is balanced by the rate of the reverse reaction. The rate of the reverse reaction, the phosphatase reaction, I just plot here, the rate as a function of the substrate concentration. The substrate is the phosphorylated form of R. And then the kinase reaction, I plot in the other direction, the rate as a function of the concentration of the substrate, which is the unphosphorylated form, going in that direction. And where these two rate curves cross, that's the steady state. But because of the saturation of these Michaelis-Menten rate laws, what we're changing, the signal is the activity of the kinase. So as we increase the activity of the kinase, we pull this curve up. And first, at low kinase levels, the intersection is down here with very little phosphorylation of the protein. And at high kinase levels, the intersection is up here. And in between, these curves very rapidly cross each other. And that's what gives the sigmoidal form of the response. As you increase the signal, the kinase strength, at first the response protein is unphosphorylated, and then very quickly it gets almost fully phosphorylated. Okay? So we call that a sigmoidal signal response curve. And I call this a buzzer because it works like a door buzzer. And you go up to the door, you push on the door buzzer. If you don't push hard enough, it doesn't buzz, right? And you have to push hard enough, and then the door buzzer starts buzzing, and then when you let up, it stops buzzing at the same place where it started buzzing. It's a sigmoidal response. Okay? Now, let's put these two motifs together. So here I have the linear signal response curve where S drives the production of R. And then R is a kinase that phosphorylates the enzyme E and transcription factor E and activates it. And the phosphorylated form of E then drives further production of R. So we have a linear signal response combined with a sigmoidal response element. So I want to look for the steady state level of R. It's just balancing synthesis with degradation. The rate of degradation of R is just increases linearly with the concentration of R. But the rate of synthesis of R is one of these sigmoidal curves that's offset by the background signal S. And then it gets magnified by this positive feedback loop. So the rate of synthesis is one of Albert's sigmoidal curves. And clearly, the rate of synthesis and the rate of degradation can intersect in three places. So we can create a bistable switch out of these two simple motifs. But how many steady states we have depends upon the strength of the signal. This is zero signal strength. As the signal strength increases, eventually we lose these two lower steady states and we only have the upper steady state. So the signal response curve has this feature. The response is the total amount of the protein R. The signal is S. At low signal strength, there's two stable steady states and an unstable. And when the signal gets past this threshold, the system switches on. And now if the signal drops to zero, it'll stay on. Okay? So this would be one of Russler's non-resettable switches. You can flip it on, but you can't flip it off. I call it a fuse because this is the way the old-fashioned fuse works, where this is current and this is whether the fuse is open or closed. Okay? Once the fuse blows, it stays blown. You with me? Any questions? Yeah, Danny?
So this seems very similar to the mechanism that governs the Novick and Weiner. Except that there isn't the possibility of just a single low steady state.
Yeah.
And is that simply because you can't move that S equals zero curve any lower?
That's why it is in this little wiring diagram. But I'm going to fix that so I can get a resettable switch.
Okay.
So the lac operon has to be a resettable switch. Okay. But this is great for apoptosis, isn't it? Apoptosis should be a fuse. Here's the living cell. It gets damaged. It triggers the apoptotic response, and the cell dies. You don't want that cell to try to change its mind and come back to life. You want that to be an irreversible decision. Once you've committed to apoptosis, even if the initial signal goes away, you don't want to try. You don't want this half-dead cell to try to resurrect itself. So you want that to be an irreversible switch. And there are lots of those developmental type processes that you want to be irreversible switches. Once you're committed to it, there's no going back. Okay? As far as apoptosis is concerned, there have been three, maybe more by now, recent papers modeling apoptosis by these kinds of irreversible switches. Okay? Now I'm going to put together two buzzers. So R is a kinase that can phosphorylate E and activate it. And E is a phosphatase that can take the phosphate group off R and activate R. Now there has to be another kinase. There's another kinase up here that phosphorylates R and turns it off. And there's another phosphatase down here. But what I'm interested in are the interactions between R and E. R activates E, and E activates R. So it's two buzzers in a positive feedback loop. And what's the signal here? What I want to use as the signal is the total amount of the R protein in the cell, whether it's phosphorylated or unphosphorylated. The total amount is what I'll consider to be the signal. Okay? Now, if we have two buzzers, then if I plot EP as a function of R, that's a buzzer. EP as a function of R is this buzzer. And R as a function of EP is a buzzer going in the other direction. And the location of this buzzer depends upon the total amount of R in the system. So as I dial up the total amount of R in the system, I move the one buzzer with respect to the other buzzer. So here I have one steady state, then I have three steady states, and then I have one steady state. So the signal response curve is one of these S-shaped curves. Low steady state until the signal gets large enough, then you switch on. And then, as you decrease the total amount of R in the system, you stay in the on state, the unphosphorylated state, until it gets low enough, and then you switch off. Okay? So this is a resettable switch, or call it a toggle switch. Peter?
In this treatment, do you assume that the upper kinase,
Yes, they're fixed. No, I assume those are Michaelis-Menten as well. Yeah, okay. Now, actually, I'll just say a little sidelight here. There are problems just kind of using Michaelis-Menten enzymes willy-nilly wherever you want. You can run into difficulties. I don't want to worry about that right now. We can patch that up, but it takes a lot of work. And this is an introductory talk. Okay?
What's the name, toggle?
Oh, toggle switch is like the light switch on the wall is a toggle switch. It has a little toggle that you flip, right? And it works like this. So if you think of the signal as the angle of the toggle, if you want to flip the lights on, you have to push the toggle up to a certain point, and then you can feel it flip, right? And the lights go on, and then they stay on. And if you want to turn them off, you have to push the toggle down, and you have to go past the point where the lights turned on before they'll switch off. You try it sometime. Maybe the modern ones might not work like this, but the old-fashioned light switches work like this. And I used this as an example in a review article I was writing one time to try to explain a toggle switch. And doggone, the referee said, that's not true. That's not the way light switches work. Maybe he has a new house with some fancy light switches in it. He said I had to take that example out. So I didn't want to fight with him. I took the example out of the paper, but I also took the light switch out of the wall in the back closet, because I knew it was a toggle switch. And I took it down to my workshop and tried to get into it, but it was all sealed up in plastic, right? And you know, it had been glued together. You couldn't take it apart. So like a good molecular biologist, I got my hammer out, and I'm bang! I hit that thing, and pow! It blew all over the shop. Because inside that thing was a spring under tension, a little rocker with a spring. And mechanically, it has exactly this bifurcation diagram. And the spring was under tension, so when I broke the thing, it went all over the place. I picked up the pieces and reconstructed it. And you could write down the differential equations. It's just a cusp catastrophe. It's one of Zeeman's catastrophe machines, is the light switch on your wall. But it's constrained to be in the bistable region all the time. Danny?
Yeah, so I'm wondering, the network diagrams are Novick and Winer.
Yeah.
And certainly you have NR1, which can be phosphorylated and dephosphorylated. But what's the other?
So that one's different because, I mean, there's positive feedback on the production. It can't be modeled by this equation. It's a different. Those are different motifs that have been put together. But the behavior of the system's the same. And that's just Rene Thom. You know, if you've seen one toggle switch, you've seen them all. They're all folds. They're all cusp catastrophes. Yeah, Hiro.
So can you convert fold switch to the fuse switch? Because, you know, sometimes in disease, I mean,
yes.
Disease,
yes.
It seems like a fuse,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
You know, but they use the total switch.
Yes.
Do you have any examples?
Exactly. So remember, if you have a toggle switch and you project down onto the control plane, you get the fold lines, and the fold lines come together into a cusp as functions of some second parameter, okay? So we pick a second parameter in the system, and as you move the second parameter, you can expect these fold lines to move. You don't know which way they'll move. You've got to do a calculation, right? But find a parameter that moves this fold in this direction, and once you've moved it over to here, then it's in the non-resendable switch. And exactly, that can be the basis of some diseases. where in the normal system you want to have a resettable switch, and in the disease state it becomes non-resettable, or vice versa. So if apoptosis is a non-resettable switch, there are circumstances, at least mutants that you can create, that turn apoptosis into a resettable switch. And those cells are really sick. Okay. Now, here's an example of coupled buzzers. Comes from the frog egg, and the protein that I've been calling R in the frog egg is called M-phase promoting factor. It's a dimeric protein that drives cells into mitosis. And it's regulated by a kinase and a phosphatase. The kinase WEE1 phosphorylates MPF and makes it inactive, so the cell is not in mitosis. That's the state in G2 of the cell cycle. CDC25 is the phosphatase that takes that phosphate group off and activates MPF and drives the cell into mitosis. But normally, CDC25 is not active. It's in the unphosphorylated state and is not active. In order to get CDC25 active, it has to be phosphorylated, and MPF is the kinase that phosphorylates CDC25. So MPF and CDC25 are caught in this positive feedback loop. And it has two stable steady states, a steady state where CDC25 is unphosphorylated and inactive, and MPF is phosphorylated and inactive. That's the G2 phase of the cell cycle. And then it has a second steady state where MPF is active, CDC25 is phosphorylated and active, and keeps MPF active. Well, they're mutual friends. And according to the theory, the control parameter, the signal, is the total amount of MPF in the system, which can be controlled, which can be manipulated experimentally by manipulating the total amount of cyclin, which is one of the components of the MPF molecule. And so experimentally, if you can manipulate the amount of cyclin in the cell, you should see the response as a toggle switch. At low levels of cyclin, MPF is off and the cell's in G2, and when you get enough cyclin in the system switches on and the cell goes into mitosis. And then to get out of mitosis and go back to interphase, you've got to come around the toggle switch. Yeah.
In addition, there is also control signal of
WEE1,
right, which is inhibited by the...
Yes, there is.
Enlarge the domain of the
stability. Those are technical details.
It
actually can reinforce. That actually gets very complicated, Albert, and it's better just to think about the simple case where WEE1 isn't controlled. Okay? Okay, now you can do this experiment. You collect frog eggs in a centrifuge tube, and you centrifuge them gently. The eggs will break, and all the trash will pellet to the bottom, and you get essentially pure cytoplasm in the centrifuge tube. And you can pull that cytoplasm out, put it in a test tube, and now it's a chemical reactor. It's not a cell anymore. And it has all the components that are needed for this system, except, let's see, you do two things. You add calcium, and that causes any cyclin molecules that are in the cytoplasm, when you add calcium, the cyclin molecules get degraded. And then you add cyclohexamide, which inhibits protein synthesis, and it prevents any further cyclin from being synthesized. So there's no cyclin there, and you can't make any cyclin. And then, experimentally, you add your own cyclin into the tube. So you make recombinant cyclin in insect cells somewhere else in the lab, purify it, and squirt it into the test tube. But the recombinant cyclin has a little piece clipped off, and the little piece you clip off is the part of the cyclin sequence that causes it to be degraded. So without that little piece, this is a stable cyclin molecule. So there's no cyclin synthesis and no cyclin degradation, and you as the experimenter get to squirt in exactly how much cyclin you want. So you can control the signal and ask, what's the response? Is MPF active or inactive? So that's exactly the experiment we did. Let's not go into the experimental details. Just want to point out, when MPF is inactive, the nuclei in the preparation look like this. The chromatin is dispersed and the nuclear envelope is intact. And when MPF gets activated, the nuclear envelope breaks down and the chromatin condenses and the nuclei try to go into mitosis. Okay? So the nuclei are indicators of the MPF activity. And the experiments were done in Jill Seibel's lab, mostly by Wei Sha. And here's one of Wei's experiments. First of all, you start with MPF in the inactive state, and all the nuclei are in interphase. And then you add cyclin to the system, and you see whether the nuclei go into mitosis or not. This is no cyclin. You give them 90 minutes. Nuclear envelope is still intact. Chromatin looks a little crazy, but the nuclear envelope is intact, until we get up to 40 nanomolar cyclin, and at this point, the nuclear envelope breaks down, and the chromatin really starts to condense. And if you do activity assays, which are harder to do, but we did them, you do the activity assays, the MPF activity is low in all of those places, and high here. So there's a very clear threshold for the activation of MPF, somewhere between 32 and 40 nanomolar cyclin. That's the bottom of the toggle switch. You have to get above 30-odd nanomolar before you can switch this thing on. Then you do the opposite experiment. You start with the system in the on state, and all the nuclei are in mitosis, and now you gradually reduce the concentration, total concentration of cyclin in the system, and you ask, below what level do you have to get before the nuclei go back to interphase? Well, that threshold is between 16 and 24 nanomolar cyclin. So clearly, these intermediate concentrations of cyclin, the system can be stably either in the off state with low MPF activity or in the on state with high MPF activity. The system is a toggle switch. It's bistable.
Do those have to be done in different experiments? Yeah,
you have to do this. It's tricky how you do the experiment. I didn't explain the protocol. Okay? Now, I mentioned early on that once you have a system that's bistable and works like a toggle switch, then if you can add some negative feedback into the system, you can turn the toggle switch into an oscillator. And the frog beat us to that, because the frog already has a negative feedback built into it. There's another protein complex called the APC, the anaphase promoting complex, and its job is to destroy proteins. And one of the proteins that the APC destroys is the cyclin component of MPF. Okay? So now I'm going to add cyclin synthesis and cyclin degradation. In other words, we take out the cyclohexamide from the preparation. And now the preparation can synthesize proteins, and it'll synthesize cyclins. It makes its own cyclin, and as it synthesizes cyclin at a constant rate, it fills up the box and increases the signal. Then, when the system finally switches on and activates MPF, one of the jobs of MPF is to activate the APC, and then one of the jobs of the APC is to destroy the cyclin and empty the box and put the signal back down again. So, here's our toggle switch. Here's our null cline for cyclin. Below this cyclin, net synthesized, and above, net degraded. So, you just run around the hysteresis loop. And this is the signal response curve. We look at the steady state MPF level as a function of the rate of cyclin synthesis. The steady states lose stability, and now they're surrounded by large amplitude limit cycles. These are Hopf bifurcations. And This was tested experimentally in Jim Furl's lab by Joe Pomerani. And here's this beautiful experiment that Pomerani did. And Pomerani's coming here later in the term, towards the end of the workshop. This is a beautiful experiment. The blue curve is the total amount of cyclin in the extract. And here you can see on the gel, the cyclin level is increasing steadily through the cycle. But the H1 kinase, the MPF activity, stays very low until the total cyclin gets past the bifurcation point. And then, the bifurcation point is somewhere around here, then the kinase activity, MPF activity, goes up because you switch to the on state. But when it switches on, that destroys the cyclin. There's the total cyclin dropping, and the MPF level has to follow it. And when you project these measured curves as functions of time onto the phase plane, you just see the system running around the limit cycle on the phase plane, running around the hysteresis loop. Okay? Direct experimental demonstration of all these theoretical properties of the control system.
Sorry. Yes. Is it possible to stop these electrons and go back to one of the two steady states?
You have to stop the oscillations, you have to either block cyclin synthesis or block cyclin degradation. And you can do either one of those things, genetically or with perturbations of some sort. Okay.
And you can pick which state you go to?
Sure. When we study in our complicated models of the cell cycle, we kind of keep track of all that. So there are mutations that interfere with these control systems and block the cell cycle in different stages by doing exactly that. And in fact, the cell naturally does it because the cell cycle, I don't want to get into too much of this, but there are these things called checkpoints in the cell cycle. So when the cell receives a certain signal, it blocks the cell cycle at a certain place. That's called a checkpoint. And that checkpoint works by blocking that negative feedback and making sure that you hang up at the correct place in the cell site. It's clear you can manipulate all these things if you can manipulate the control parameters. And of course you can manipulate the control parameters, either genetically or biochemically. And this is exactly what the cell does, okay, to control its physiology.
Yeah. So when people talk about oscillations arising through this mechanism, they usually assume that the negative feedback is a lot slower than the dynamics of the positive feedback. Is that true here?
That's true here because the slowest process is cyclin synthesis. And that's what sets the pace for this oscillation. And then the cyclin degradation is pretty fast. And the phosphorylation, dephosphorylation reactions are very fast. So there is a separation of time scales. Okay, so I call this whole thing that I've been trying to illustrate the dynamical perspective of molecular cell biology. What the molecular biologist supplies for us, molecular genetics, biochemistry, cell biology, they gather this information from these three different streams and try to put together a hypothetical molecular mechanism to account for the physiological properties of the cells on the basis of the underlying genetics and biochemistry. And that's basically where most molecular biology papers stop. That's the last figure in the paper, which is the hypothetical mechanism. And for us, that's the first figure in our paper. How do you know that that molecular mechanism, that hypothetical molecular mechanism, is sufficient to account for the observed physiology of the cell? It's guesswork, right? You're guessing and you're going in this direction and you can't go back directly. How do you confirm these molecular mechanisms? How do you disprove your hypotheses? How do you improve your hypotheses? Okay, so what we try to do is convert the molecular mechanism into a set of reaction kinetic equation, just like you do for the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction. And then think of those kinetic equations as defining a vector field in the state space, which are the concentrations of all the variables. And then you need to characterize that vector field in terms of its attractors and repellers, its stable steady states, stable oscillations, and also its unstable states. And the transients, as you go between those attractors, those are all properties of the vector field. And the vector field comes from the kinetic equations, and the kinetic equations come from the molecular mechanism. Okay, so this is a direct line using these mathematical principles to figure out what this mechanism is capable of doing. And you characterize, the simplest way to characterize these attractors and repellers is in terms of bifurcation diagrams, which plot the attractors and repellers as functions of the control parameters. And then what I've been showing you is that bifurcation diagrams are essentially signal response curves. They tell you how the control system responds to the signals that it can receive through its parameters. And signal response curves, of course, directly determine what the physiology of the cell is going to be. So we can complete the loop here, and we can see what the implications of the molecular mechanism are. And is it sufficient to explain the biology of the cells? Deborah, do you have a question?
Actually, you just said the word that I was thinking of, sufficient. So it almost seems like when you were discussing things and people were asking questions, mm-hmm. you would say things like, well, that just complicates the issue, or well, we don't need this part mm-hmm. of it to mm-hmm. understand it. Mm-hmm. But I would say, coming from the other angle, that's what makes it difficult for us to make those models, is because there's a lot more to it mm-hmm. than the little piece that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And so I see a big disconnect with mm-hmm. some of the things that...
Okay, that's fair enough. I'll answer that question in just a second, okay? What I want to point out first is we can go backwards along this route, okay? By looking at the physiology of the cells, we see what the signal response curve is. When we see that signal response curve from the right light, We know what bifurcation diagram has to underlie that kind of signal response. Is it an oscillator? Is it a switch? What kind of a switch is it? Okay. Then we have an idea of what that kind of bifurcation diagram lies behind that signal response curve. And then we can ask ourselves this is all mathematics, dynamical systems theory, is a particular mechanism, that is, a particular set of nonlinear differential equations, capable of giving us that bifurcation diagram? And if so, in what region of parameter space? This is the technicalities of doing the modeling. But it allows us to work backwards towards the mechanism. And then we can say this part of the mechanism is sufficient to explain this part of the physiology. Okay, now you have something else you want me to do? Okay, same trick. Okay? And then that's how we build up more and more complex models of more and more of the physiological characteristics of the cells, by working piece by piece through this, by this perspective, okay? And as far as I'm concerned, see, I don't know how you could possibly do it any other way, right? Just like you can't understand a complicated piece of electrical machinery without getting the wiring diagram and breaking the wiring diagram down into little bits and pieces and do the basic things and see how now all the things fit together. Okay? So, you know, I have a great deal of respect, of course, for the molecular biologists who do this. We couldn't even get started without that. But you can't end there. That's not the end of the story, right? We're only just getting started. We have to do the rest of this, it seems to me, to confirm our models, to find out where we're making mistakes, and in order to start to build up more and more complex and accurate models of these control systems. Okay? So I need to stop. This is a good place to stop, although I probably have another dozen slides. But I'll just tell you, I just want to say one more thing, okay? If you believe this, then the whole key are the bifurcation diagrams. That's the crucial link. Because, I mean, it's not hard to hypothesize mechanisms. Once you have a hypothetical mechanism, you can convert it into rate equations. The computer can do that for you, okay? And you can do simulations, but they're not going to tell you very much. because you don't know where in parameter space you need to lie. The whole key to this thing are the bifurcation diagrams, because the bifurcation diagrams are a consequence of the differential equation. And they're the link to the signal response curves, which are the link to the physiology. So from my point of view, the understanding, the molecular understanding of the physiological responses of a cell, that is the information processing that's done by this chemical reaction network, the key to understanding that are in understanding the basic bifurcations that can occur in nonlinear differential equations. Those bifurcations that I was showing you, I didn't give them names, right? The nose of the curve is called a saddle node bifurcation, and a hop bifurcation generates oscillations. Those are the two, you know, big dude bifurcations that everybody learns. It's the first thing you learn, okay? So now the question is, if I'm right that those bifurcations are the key to connecting the molecular biology to the physiology, then the question becomes, well, how many different kinds of bifurcations are there? Are there hundreds of different kinds of bifurcations? Maybe there are, right? Biological cells are really complicated, you know? Maybe we should expect there are hundreds of different things that can happen, hundreds of different bifurcations. As a matter of fact, that ain't true. There are only a handful. There are only five elementary bifurcations of nonlinear differential equations. And the next couple of slides show you what the other ones are. I'll just name them. There's a saddle node bifurcation and the Hopf bifurcation, which we've seen. And there are non-local bifurcations called a cyclic fold bifurcation, which is a saddle node of periodic orbits. There is a saddle loop bifurcation. There's a SNCC bifurcation. That's five. Those are the big five. But what I'm trying to tell you is this is manageable. You can actually get introduced to all of the necessary bifurcations in a couple of hours lecture. Okay? And those are the basic building blocks of all, they have to be the basic building blocks of all the signal response curves that underlie cell physiology. I think this is inescapable, because physiology comes from molecular biology. Molecular biology is just a chemical reaction system, which is just a set of nonlinear differential equations, and there's only so many things that can be done generically. This is what René Thom told us, or tried to tell me, years and years ago, and we didn't believe him. Okay? But it's true. There's only this handful of bifurcations, these generic bifurcations. You can put them together in all kinds of weird ways to do all kinds of interesting signal processing. Those are details. Before you'll ever be able to do that, you first have to understand the basic building blocks. Yeah, well, the codimension, those are, so the ones I mentioned are the codimension 1 bifurcations. And this is what the next, some point I'll do the last third of this lecture. The codimension 2 bifurcations tell you how the codimension 1 bifurcations fit together. And that starts to get pretty hairy. And then there are higher codimension 3 and codimension 4 bifurcations that we actually don't know very much about. The mathematics hasn't been developed yet. But it's surprising how much cell biology can be understood in terms of these generic codimension 1 and codimension 2 bifurcations.
That's also because there are a few parameters
in something. Yeah, well, how we're going to make all this work, I don't know yet. It is a complicated system, but so is a Pentium processor.
Yeah. It's designed very carefully to be complicated and be very stuff.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But that's true. Yeah.
And, you know, it's a moot point as to whether evolution is there.
Yeah, we don't know.
And some systems do not display bifurcation.
They look dull, yeah, yeah. I'm not interested in them.
You should not forget. There are many reactions.
Lots of biology is dull. Oh boy, I hope that's not on tape.
That's really my new book. subsidy applications of the laws.
It seems to me that you could have signal response codes without understanding the bifurcation diagrams.
But maybe the point is that by understanding the bifurcation diagrams, you understand the multitude of signal response codes that are possible in the system.
So, like when you have the kinetic equations, you could start with a signal and get the response, and then do another value of the signal, get another response, and show that there's a signal response curve. But you are arguing that by that you don't understand the system.
The system I know best is the cell cycle. And the cell cycle, underlying the cell cycle are several switches and probably several oscillators that are coupled pretty intimately together. And they give a pretty complicated signal response curve that we think we understand pretty well now, although it took many years to do this. But the complicated codimension 1 and codimension 2 bifurcation diagrams that we use for the cell cycle now, they're all built up from these pieces I've been trying to explain. Now, whether this perspective is going to solve all problems in molecular cell biology, probably not. But it's worth pursuing, and we know that it works for several pretty classical systems now that have been analyzed by this technique. But they're not simple signal response curves like a toggle switch. They're more complicated because you put together several switches and oscillators. And okay.
So if you find a complicated signal response curve, then you would be able to see what kind of bifurcation.
We try to break it down into its simpler pieces, and build models of the simple pieces first, realizing that they are not going to explain everything about the physiology. They're only partial models. But you have to solve the partial problems first before you can start to put together the whole picture. Yeah.
So do you have any idea? So you were talking about the switch and oscillator. Do you have any idea to on the mechanism to build a volume which covers a very huge dynamic range? Do you have any idea
to build a volume?
Turn it up and down. But each power is a very dynamic range. The volume in terms of space, or signal response. For example, transcription is a gene expression is, about a huge variety. Genes are expressed on, 1,000 or 10,000, but the some genes are expressed, say, 1 over 0.1. So, do you have any idea to build such kind of volume?
So you're talking maybe about sensitivity and robustness kind of issues?
Because, flexible and robust.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea?
Well, generically, we know what the bifurcations look like, kind of generically. But where the bifurcations live and how big the domain of bistability is, or the domain of oscillations, those can be very sensitive to the mechanism and to the parameters in the mechanism. And a model may have some flexibility in this regard, may not. I don't pay right now too much attention to these kind of philosophical issues about the robustness and sensitivity, because we're so much focused right now on explaining a particular set of experiments. But some of these experiments, like the bistable domain in the frog egg, we know isn't real big. It's about a factor of 3, the ratio of those two. Right? And that's experimentally measurable, and it comes right out of the theory, and that doesn't worry me. I don't want to make it 30 because it's 3. But There are other problems that we're working on right now where we have a model that shows bistability, but the domain is really small compared to what the experiment is. And we're scratching our head and trying to figure out, you know, are we just in the wrong region of parameter space, or do we have the wiring diagram wrong? But I don't have any general rules for how to make a bifurcation diagram do what I want it to do. Okay, I think people are running out of steam. Let's break for lunch, and the afternoon is free. I'll be happy to talk with anybody in the afternoon. If we have plans about, remember, 4th of July is holiday tomorrow. You can come here and work if you want to. A lot of us will be going to festivities. So make connections if you have some plans. We have to be a little bit informal about this. I haven't organized any social program for the 4th of July. Maybe something will nucleate. Yeah, 3:15 is coffee, so maybe we can talk about plans at coffee time. Okay?
Put it on the web.
Then we can put it on the web if we have some ideas. Yeah.